Hello and welcome to the No Ceilings NBA Draft Show. Today is a deep dives episode, so I'm your host for the day, Nick Agar Johnson, here with my co-host Paige Otto. Paige, how are you doing this fine evening?
I'm doing great. First week of NBA basketball is back. College basketball starts sooner than we know it, so it's a good time.
College basketball starts not soon enough for Kings and Suns fans, but you know, that's a problem that we can deal with another day. So we're going to do the same sort of format that we did for the last episode. That, spoiler alert, will be the format that we'll be doing going forward for these. So today we're doing our deep dives on our two prospects, and we're going to flip the order today. So we're going to go with your chosen prospect first. I'm honestly surprised that it took until episode two for you to pick a Michigan State guy. So that was great restraint on your part. I appreciate that. But you couldn't hold off for too long. So today we're going to be covering Cohen Carr, who came into his freshman year with a ton of hype. It was not quite as people might have hoped, but last year was a real breakout for Cohen Carr in a lot of ways. So let's start with sort of general overview. Why did you choose to go with Cohen Carr for today's episode?
Yeah, I think obviously, I'm Michigan State alum. Nick mentioned, you know, I tried really hard to wait maybe until like the fifth episode to bring up a Michigan State guy. But I think it's warranted just because this year is really Cohen Carr's make or break year due to the fact that it's the first year in a while that Tom Izzo and Michigan State are playing with not a veteran backcourt either. They lost, obviously, Jace Richardson, Trey Holloman, Xavier Booker also came in with Cohen Carr, too. He went to UCLA, Akins as well. So it's going to be a big time for Cohen Carr to set up in that role. And obviously Jeremy Fears and Curtin to kind of take over those playmaking abilities for him. But when you look at Cohen Carr, you think, you know, he's a freak athlete. He's a ferocious jumper. Arguably, if not the best leaper in the draft class and in college basketball in general. He's 6'6", 225 pounds. It's been a long day. But he's just a guy that, you know, you're not going to look for him to shoot. Obviously, that's one of his big concerns. And I'm sure me and Nick will dive into that deeper. But he's a guy that, you know, most of his time is spent at the rim. And also with the play style that Tom Izzo likes to run, it's very guard heavy. So this year, it's, you know, you're going to look for Cohen Carr to kind of have more of a usage rate and kind of just be able to not only create for himself, but also create for others, because Tom Izzo kind of likes to use him as like a ball mover. So he's really setting up these guards a lot of the times. But with that too, you want him to kind of spread the floor because he has kind of a liability on the perimeter. If we dive into the numbers a little bit, he only shot 33% from 3-point range, only had, I believe, 15 attempts on the season, 70% at the free throw line, only 97 attempts there. He had, when you look at his at the rim finishes, 70% tile, excellent on synergy, 77% of the time he was here, 53% of that was dunking at the rim. He only missed 10 dunks at the season, so he's not really going to miss a lot because that's kind of like his bread and butter there. But with Cohen Carr, they just had an expedition game against Bowling Green where he was a leading scorer there. I believe he had 17 points, 5 blocks, and 4 assists, and it was 7-11 from the field. So that's a really great sign to start the season with this kind of new look Michigan State team that we're kind of not used to, in the sense of not having a lead guard, and Cohen Carr's kind of have to, like, you know, it's kind of his breakout year in a sense. I kind of have him, I think, 55 on my board. But a lot of people are really excited. I know they play UConn tonight in the expedition game. Obviously, Mullins is out. But I think if Cohen Carr can kind of, you know, build off the momentum from Bowling Green, it'll kind of give us a good outlook of what's to come earlier in the season for him. But there's still a lot of questions. His defense, you know, he kind of gets caught a lot in terms of, you know, his lateral and vertical ability. Obviously, he's super fast, especially in transition. You're kind of going to look to him to, you know, run the floor as well, because he uses his athleticism so well, but he also uses his athleticism to hide a lot of his flaws as well. So when you look at him, you're obviously going to be in awe just because of he's amazing to watch. But in terms of, you know, really getting down to the nitty gritty, you can see a lot of his flaws be exposed. And I'm kind of worried in a sense of not having, you know, Jace, Akins, Holloman as kind of like the lead drivers in offense, that he's kind of going to get exposed a lot more than he would have last year.
The defensive discussion is interesting. A lot of it, I think, is it trends in commonality with what we were talking about with Ian Jackson last week of he has all the athletic tools, right? And, you know, for a lot of players, just effort on the defensive end is so much of the battle. But, you know, oddly enough, I mean, the other player we're going to talk about, he isn't as fleet of foot as Colin Carr, and that's, it's a whole different setup. We don't need to get into that quite yet. But that's sort of what interests me in particular about what this year could look like for Carr, because, you know, as you mentioned, the shooting was the 33% doesn't bother me anywhere near as much as the 15 attempts. That's where that's the real struggle. And the free throw thing is interesting. I mean, I think it's worth pointing out that he got to the line a lot more last year, and he also hit 70%, which, you know, it's not great, but it's a far cry from the 56% mark his freshman year, which, you know, that's really, I think there are two things that stand out to me for what I would hope to see from Colin Carr this coming year. And the first is the most obvious, which is he has 29 assists total for his college career.
Yeah.
Across 2 years. And, you know, you mentioned the sort of departure of a lot of the, you know, a lot of the offensive responsibilities, a lot of the guard room, you know, changing over. And, you know, that's, again, that's a situation where when we were talking about Magoon Gwath having really low assist numbers, bit less of a problem than, you know, for a wing forward type who you want the ball at least going through their hands more often than just, hey, you know, right around the basket, or, you know, hey, Magoon's open for a three, right? Take the shot. It's going to be a very different outlook for Colin Carr this year. So that's really sort of the main area for me, is looking at what he can do as a playmaker, because, you know, something we talked about last week was how one trick ponies are really getting drummed out of the league. And so for Colin Carr, you know, as you mentioned, absolutely spectacular athlete. And you mentioned some of the numbers. I have a few that are particularly intriguing to me that I want to bring up. But, you know, that's really the sell, is you're not going to find many people who can jump like he can, who can run the floor like he can. And so then the question becomes, okay, but what else, right? Like, if he, and I think it's safe to assume that he's not going to suddenly just revolutionize his shooting and become this, you know, high volume, high effect, high efficiency shooter. So given that that is more of a long-term thing at best, right? Like, hopefully it works out, but even best case scenario, that's probably not going to happen this year. The question for me then becomes, okay, what else is he doing to make defenses not want to have the ball in his hands? And by far the biggest of those is, okay, can you be effective at running the offense? And it's one of those things where it's difficult to tell of how much were his low playmaking numbers due to him not having that passing feel, and how much of it was that's just not his role. Like, he was a play finisher, and that's still primarily what he's going to be doing, is finishing plays, right? But given that the shooting as a whole, I think the playmaking element needs to take a pretty significant step forward. That being said, you mentioned a few of these numbers, and I do just want to go, you know, go into them a bit further. It's not just that he was a 90th percentile transition finisher per synergy and 96th percentile overall offensively. It's also that he was in the 97th percentile for how frequently he was finishing in transition. Like, it's not just, oh, okay, when he gets the ball on the fast break, it's going to turn into points. It's he's getting out ahead of everybody consistently. And, you know, you mentioned the dunks thing. Like, yeah, you know, it was sort of similar to the Gwath discussion of, yeah, okay, you know, missing a bunch of dunks is not great, but those are still the most efficient plays possible. And he was in the 98th percentile in terms of dunk frequency, which, you know, that sort of tells the story right there. Is, yeah, he missed 10 dunks. That's because he attempted 74 of them, right? Yeah. It's like, you don't see numbers in the 60s for how many dunks guys throw down when they're 6'6 wing forward types, right? It's like, usually when you're seeing a number like that, it's like, oh, okay, yeah, Ryan Kalkbrenner had like 65 dunks, because all he needs to do is raise his hand up a little bit, and that's all it takes, right? Yeah. But, you know, for Colin Carr, it's a very interesting dilemma, because what he does well, he does exceptionally well. And what he doesn't do well is a struggle. And I'm curious for your thoughts on the defensive side of things, because really for me, that's sort of the area of, if he's going to be the kind of offensive player that he has proven to be over the first couple of years of his college career, he's going to need to be a spectacular defender to, you know, sort of fit what we were talking about, right? Of like, there has to be more than one thing that you're good at, right? And for Konkar being as ridiculous of an athlete as he is, you know, you can name examples throughout prospect history, throughout NBA history of, like, you know, the guy I always go back to is Cliff Alexander, where he was the fifth ranked prospect in his high school class, and he got to college and all of a sudden he couldn't just dunk over everybody anymore. And, you know, he flamed out pretty quickly after that. And Konkar is above that level, but his defense also isn't where it would need to be for him to be more than like, oh, okay, this is a fun guy to give a cup of coffee to because it's really fun to watch him run in the open court, but not someone who's going to establish himself as a long-term rotation guy.
Yeah, I think when you look at Konkar, obviously his leaping ability is something we're going to hone, right, and that he's exceptional at, but he only had 0.5 blocks. He only averaged 0.5 blocks on the season. And when you look at, you know, his blocks, really he's, you know, he just uses his athleticism so much that he kind of gets tunnel vision in the sense of, you know, am I in the correct positioning? Am I boxing this guy out? Am I just like up there to get a board? And that's kind of like his role. And that's what kind of Tom Izzo, you know, instills in his, you know, younger guys and also his veteran players, as well as, you know, Konkar is going to have to take a leap there. You know, I want him to average at least 2 blocks a game just because of, you know, I think his usage is going to go up. I think he's going to be, you know, one of the key assets to this Michigan State team. And when you look at the numbers even more, you know, he has 8.7% offensive rebound percentage, 11.2 on the other side of the ball. And if you look at it, you know, you have Jackson Kohler, Carson Cooper. They're going to be the ones that are going to clean up the boards most of the time. But Konkar also has the ability with his, you know, body as well to get up and get those boards and push it up the floor to, you know, the likes of Jeremy Fear and Curtin. So I just want him to, you know, obviously we want him to, you know, grow in his shooting abilities, you know, maybe mix in his a little bit more jumpers as well. We can dive into those numbers as well, especially his transition two numbers. But I would just want him to grow in that area because he's more than capable. It's just the likes of, you know, is he going to be asked to, you know, be an offensive asset that he really hasn't been? I mean, last year he only started one game, but he played, I think, the fifth most minutes on the team, which is insane when you think about it. And I think he also had the second most blocks on the team too, with 28. So when you look at those, you know, he's not really, you don't really look at his own rim protector, but when you kind of look at the numbers for his size and position, he definitely adds a ton of value in that sense of providing that for Michigan State that, you know, Carson Cooper, Jackson Kohler, they're going to get on the boards for you and they're going to block out, you know, the, you know, center and forward positions where Konkar can definitely, you know, play 3 through 5, you know, but he's not really going to play the center role. He's more like a 3 or 4, but he can absolutely, you know, make up for what Cooper and Kohler lack.
It's interesting because one of the points that we talked about with Ian Jackson last week, I think applies to Konkar, honestly, on both ends of the floor, of something that surprised me when I was looking at the numbers. It wasn't just that the, you know, steal and block rates weren't as high as you would hope. It was that he also averaged barely a foul a game.
Yeah.
And like, you know, it feels almost hypocritical because, you know, part of what I love about Magoon Gwat's game, which is why I brought him up, was how exceptional of a shot blocker he was while not fouling, right? But when you have Konkar's athletic profile, like, I don't know. I mean, especially because he has all the physical tools and because effort is so much of defense, it almost makes me, like, I think I would be happier with his game if he had, you know, 2 blocks a game and 3 fouls a game, as opposed to, like, you know, up to a block a game, but still at a foul a game. It's like when you're, it's not, cause it's not just that he's a ridiculous athlete. It's also that, you know, he's got a solid, sturdy frame, right? I mean, you know, 6'6", 225, you know, watching Tyrese Halliburton's early career when he was 6'6", 175, it's like, it's, you know, it's a bit of a different deal, right? And it's not, you know, there are plenty of high flyers who, you know, once they actually have to get bodied up by guys, you know, they're skinny and they don't weigh very much and they have pogo sticks so they can get up there really high, right? That's not the Konkar build. And so for me, a lot of the question, and honestly, this applies on the other end of the floor too, because he averaged under a turnover a game as well, you know, and we already brought up the assist numbers, right? Not particularly great when you have 20 assists on the year, and that's better than your freshman year when you had 9. But, you know, just generally speaking, it's like he's got all the tools. And really, if given how much of the question for him is, can he get to the point where he's a really valuable defensive player in addition to being this ridiculously efficient play finisher on the offensive end, it's like, if he doesn't show that he can do what he can do out there on the defensive end, then it's gonna seem like he's more passive than he is. And it's not like he hasn't had passive moments on the defensive end, but it's like, man, I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head of this has got to be his breakout year. And it's funny because in a way last year was a bit of his breakout year of, yeah. Oh, okay, he's not just a bit player, right? You know, even though he only did start the one game, he did average 21 minutes. You know, he did literally almost triple his shooting volume, right? You know, he wasn't shooting threes, but just in terms of shots overall, you know, he was shooting a lot more, getting to the line a lot more, hitting at the line when he got there a lot more. But he's really going to have to bring it on the defensive end this year to become the kind of prospect that he and all of his fans would want him to be. And it's going to be interesting to see how that sort of plays out over the first couple months of the season, because again, he's got the physical tools. The questions are, I mean, the playmaking stuff, it's a lot of theory with the playmaking stuff because we really haven't seen it. But with the defensive stuff, it's like, man, if he could just be in the lane more, like, yeah, he might get more fouls, but he can be an intimidating presence if he gets to the point where he's there often enough to be intimidating.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think I'm a little bullish on him, kind of like how I was bullish on Xavier Booker. Like, I'm just waiting and waiting and waiting for, like, just, like, the it factor, or, like, them to kind of, you know, evolve, right, in terms of, like, their archetype as a prospect. And I think, you know, he's doubled, you know, his freshman year, he didn't even attempt a three-pointer. He shot 15 last year. You know, maybe he attempts 30 this year. It's the not knowing part with him. It's kind of like the not knowing of this Michigan State team too, just because so many changes and so many players departed and they didn't really get a lot of guys in the transfer portal. That's not really Tom Izzo's bread and butter. He loves to have a veteran led team. But Colin Carr is one of the guys that, you know, Michigan State is going to heavily rely on, and he's not used to that. Right. He kind of had, you know, I mentioned it, I'm going to keep mentioning it, like Jace Akins, like, they're very guard heavy when it comes to Michigan State basketball, and this year they're not. So Colin Carr, like, this is his time to shine. And I think, you know, I mentioned his transition twos. You know, he was in the 97% tile in transition, and he shot 75% on transition twos last year too, which is incredible. But when you look at his jumpers, he was only in the 24% tile and shot 30% on only, you know, 30 attempts. And a lot of those, you know, his three-point attempts, when you look at his catch and shoot, like, he does have to have a lot of time, right, to get the shot off. It's kind of slow, but because, you know, they're using him as a ball mover, he is available. He is, you know, he can get open, but he just needs a lot of time to get those shots off. And I would like to see, you know, how active he is, you know, around the rim in transition, kind of utilizing that, you know, with, you know, spacing the floor and not being such a big liability, because they're going to, you know, that's going to, people or opponents are going to see that, you know, right out of the gate with Michigan State. But when you look at NBA comps, the one I really like for Colin Carr is Derrick Jones Jr. Just because of, they have a very similar archetype. Colin Carr, believe it or not, is about 15 pounds heavier than Derrick Jones. But when you just look at, you know, the leaping ability, dunking ability, I think Colin Carr kind of has a little bit more juice to him in that sense that, you know, DJJ does. But, you know, he was undrafted in 2016 out of UNLV. And he didn't really show, you know, any shooting promise in college. And not saying Colin Carr has or given us enough there, but there's little bits and pieces that you can go off of. You know, his shot from the free throw line, it doesn't look bad at all, in my opinion. But I think, you know, getting to the line more, you know, showing that he can't, like, he's at the rim 70% of the time. There's no reason why he can't, you know, have at least 5 free throw attempts per game. So I think that's another aspect of his game that I'm looking forward to watching, just because of what role he will be in this year.
I do want to have one further sort of discussion on the shooting stuff before we move on to the next player. And all of this comes with the small sample size caveat. I mean, he took literally 30 jump shots total last season, which, yeah, you know, not particularly big sample size. Yeah. But what stands out to me looking at the breakdown of those is that on his catch and shoots, he was right about average. On his off the dribble jumpers, he was awful.
Yeah.
And that, I think, it's interesting because if those were the Ian Jackson numbers, I would be a lot more concerned. For the Cone Carr numbers, it's more, I tend to lean on the examples that I love way too heavily. And I'm sure people who have listened to this podcast for a long time are fed up with it. But, you know, watching Daron Holmes' shooting development over the course of his Dayton career, he took 7 attempts his freshman
year. That's your guy, too.
That is my guy. Well, that's why I'm going with him, right? He took 7 attempts his freshman year. He took slightly more his sophomore year and hit like 31% of them. And then his junior year was the year where he hit 38% of them and took like 2.5 per game. But what stood out to me about the shooting development was it wasn't just, oh, okay, lock this guy in the gym, have him take 1,000 shots. And, you know, once he's taken his 1,000 shots, you open the doors again, right? It was very, very targeted of the role for a 6'10 athlete who's, you know, somewhere in the power forward center mold is this is not someone who's going to be taking a lot of shots off the dribble. Almost all of his shots are going to be trailer threes in transition. They're going to be kicking back to him at the top of the arc, because part of the reason I love Daron Holmes so much, all of you will get to know this over the course of this year if you haven't learned it already, is I am supremely a sucker for big men who can pass, and Daron Holmes 100% fit that mold. But it was like, okay, it's not just that he's taking these shots and making them at a decent clip. It's that he knew how to develop his shooting game. He knew the areas where he was going to be getting the ball. Cone Carr is not going to be taking a lot of jumpers off the dribble, even in the best version of him. So the fact that the splits break down and, you know, small sample size again, yada, yada, yada. But the fact that he was decent enough at catch and shoots, those are the jump shots that teams are going to want him to take, right? They're not going to want him to, you know, meanderingly dribble his way into an 18 footer, right? That's not his game. And so even though the shooting numbers overall were pretty bad, the fact that they were dragged down as much as they were by the off the dribble stuff is actually encouraging to me, because to me that says, okay, the shots that he's going to be taking, if he's taking jump shots, he's getting better at those. The free throw percentage improvement was huge for me. You know, not just the fact that he was getting to the line, but the fact that once you reach the 70% mark, it's like, okay, it's not, you know, hack a shack is not fair, because even at 56%, you're not going to be hacking guys like that. But it's more of a thing where, especially given how insane of an athlete Cone Carr is, when he's shooting 56%, it's like, just don't let him take the shot, right? Like, just, you know, hit him in the legs and like, don't let him dunk on you. As opposed to once he gets up to 70%, it's like, okay, you know, there's less of a sort of fear of, is this going to be a problem if this guy goes to the line, and more of a situation of, okay, he's got the frame, he's got the athleticism, and he's getting to the line more often. But more importantly, he's gotten to the point where, yeah, okay, this is like 70% of the free throw line. That's a really efficient look. 56%, that's worse than his dunk and layup finishing. Oh, not layup finishing quite, but worse than his at-rim finishing overall.
Yeah, I totally agree with all your points, especially like when you think of him too, he doesn't have the ball in his hands, you know, a ton, if not at all, other than, you know, he's passing off to his guards or maybe taking a few dribbles in the paint and then relocating and getting out of the way, right? So he can come in for a lob or a dunk or whatever the case may be. And when you look at his drives too, when the ball is in his hands, most of the time it's straight to the basket. So 66% of the time his drives are straight to the basket, and he shot a little under 55% there. But you know, it's just kind of like the what if situation of what, you know, he's going to look like in terms of, you know, everything that we want him to improve on this year. How is Michigan State going to look? And I think a lot of it also comes down to, is Tom Izzo really going to let him, you know, be Cone Carr? So I'm kind of looking forward to that the most, and I'm excited, not just because, you know, I went to Michigan State and, you know, he's kind of, I just, you know, love watching Michigan State basketball in general, but I just really want this, you know, to be his breakout year for like him as well. And obviously, as, you know, a fan, love the NBA draft as well, but just, I think this is a big year for him, and I'm going to say it a lot, but I think a lot of people are really excited. I know Steven and Jam, kind of, you know, he's kind of the athlete that has like helium in his legs. Never heard that before, but it was a great analogy on Steven's part. But I totally agree with that. I think he's going to be super fun to watch this year.
Shall we move on to our second prospect?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, so if you haven't figured out the pattern of this show already, where Paige picks an uber athletic wing slash guard and I pick a big man with athleticism questions who can potentially shoot and really can pass, hey, here we go. So I guess technically Magoon Guoff can't really pass to the degree that Alex Condon can, but Alex Condon is the guy who I picked for this week, and I had him as a first round prospect last year. I have him a first round prospect right now. I assume that things will stay that way. Obviously, he was a huge part of the national championship winning Florida Gators. And the questions with Alex Condon really, for me, come almost entirely on the offensive end. I mean, he's listed at 6'11", 6'11", 7 foot. He's in that big man range, but he moves like a much smaller player in a way that allows him to essentially be the kind of free safety defensive big man that, you know, pretty much since the LeBron Miami Heat era, every team has been looking for, okay, who's the guy who's big, who can also slide his feet with pretty much everybody. And that's Alex Condon. And so that is the majority of the appeal for me and for, I think, most evaluators. He's not a ridiculous shot blocker. Like, he's not Magoon Guoff getting, 2.5 blocks a game, but he's the kind of guy who's pretty much always in the right position. He shuts down passing lanes. You know, he gets in passing lanes a decent amount in terms of getting his own steals, but really a lot of it for him is just controlling the defensive end of the floor. And then the question becomes, can he do enough offensively to get himself out there on the floor? And a big part of that was that he shot 33% from deep last year on more than 15 attempts, not quite the volume problem of Konkar, but still very much a volume problem. He has shot under 100 three-pointers for his 2 years in college. He's at 96 across 2 years. And that's the kind of thing where, again, given the free throw numbers, I mean, he shot 60% from the line last year, 67% the year before, both on significantly larger sample sizes than the three-point shooting. I'm more worried about Condon as a shooter than Magoon Guoff. I think that's, that's really the long and short of it for me, is that his offensive profile will really be boosted if he can actually shoot threes. The good news for him is that because of how great of an athlete he is, he's also a 91st percentile transition guy. He doesn't get out in transition as often as Konkar does, but that's, running the floor is something he does exceptionally well. And also, passing, playmaking. I mean, Florida ran a lot. Obviously, they ran most of the offense through Walter Clayton, right? But they used Alex Condon as a hub quite a lot of the time. And because he has that shooting potential, not at the point where anyone would call him a knockdown shooter, or even as someone, I think Magoon Guoff is more of a shooter rather than a potential shooter, which is more of where I am with Condon. His passing is huge. His transition play is very helpful. He's solid around the basket. But ultimately, for me, evaluating him as a real shooter gives a very, very different level of outcome than where he's at right now, which is potential shooter. Like, if he shows up this year and he's hitting 37-38% of his threes and taking like three or four of them a game, he might be, on the just outside the lottery conversation for me, because that's how much of a difference maker he can be defensively. Is just, if you can get to the point where you're comfortable with him as a shooter, then that really opens up the rest of his game. And the other side is, I have to acknowledge that a lot of people really only saw Alex Condon during the tournament and during the last two games of the tournament, where he was hurt and was, struggling with his offense. He was not trying to shoot much. And I think that gave a slightly biased perspective on what his game is, which is, he's kind of a reluctant shooter, but he's nowhere near as reluctant as he was in the national championship game, where he was hobbled and basically just out there to defend. But, if that's all you saw of him, then I think you'd get a very different impression than what I think he actually is as a prospect, which is a very real defensive prospect. And if the shooting can go from theoretical to actual, I think he's a clear first round pick.
Yeah, I agree. And it's to note too, Condon, when you look at him, like I think he's actually not extremely athletic, but he's super athletic and mobile for a big man, right? When you look at his background, he played Australian football, he played water polo. You know, he was involved in a lot of sports. He got kind of a late start to basketball. And I think with him, he was kind of the glue guy, the key piece to, you know, Florida winning the national championship, right? Kind of without him, he did a lot for, you know, Walter Clayton, Will Richard. And he just basically set the table a lot for them in general. And he's kind of like the silent key, right? You know, obviously he tested the draft waters last year and kind of bet on himself this year. But he does everything that, you know, you want in a modern big man. Just looking at the numbers a little bit, he had 103 offensive rebounds, which was the third most in a season in Florida, 7 double-doubles. He had double figures 18 times and 10-plus rebounds 10 times. Per Synergy, opponents only shot 42% at the basket. He had a 5.5% block rate, 5.8% last year. And he did all of this too with only averaging about 2.3 fouls per season. So I think that attributes, you know, his background. He's very in control of his body, and he's a great mover both laterally and vertically as well. And when you look at these big men too, you know, you don't really expect them to play water polo or have kind of like a versatile, you know, sports background, right? It's kind of out of the ordinary a little bit, but you can obviously see it with Condon as well. And I think he has great hands as well for a big man. And you kind of mentioned his shooting a little bit, you know, as a spot up shooter, he shot, I believe 46%. He really does have to have his feet set and enough time to get a shot off. He has a very slow arching shot. I mean, he kind of has to go like this, right? especially when he has enough time. And then when he's kind of like on the run a little bit or kind of out of position, he has real trouble, you know, setting his foot and kind of just looks really clunky. I would love to know your thoughts on that as well. That's kind of just what I've observed looking at him.
Yeah, I do actually want to go back to another point that you made earlier, which I think is very important, which is, you know, the playing multiple sports background thing. It's, I mean, you know, this is one of those things where getting into my nerdy psychology background of, you know, reading about, hey, you know, it makes complete sense that, you know, all these guys who specialize in basketball and only play basketball super, super young, and they get all these wear and tear injuries. And it's like, well, that shouldn't be particularly a surprise to anyone because A, all you're doing are the same kinds of movements, right? And B, you know, AAU schedules are so insane at this point that it's like, it's almost expected that, you know, baseball players will have a Tommy John before they end high school, or, you know, basketball players will have like an ACL tear before they end high school. And, you know, the multi-athlete sort of deal leads to a lot, you know, it's something that we talk about, I think, a lot with, this is a dicey realm of conversation, but with very specific people of like, oh, Hakeem Olajuwon only played soccer growing up. Oh, Joel Embiid only played, like, you know, Pascal Siakam is like, it's a very specific weird thing about that we don't need to get particularly into. But I think the multiple athlete background is something that is getting drummed out of youth sports in America in a way that's very concerning, which of course is not a problem for someone who grows up in Australia, right? So yeah, that's something that I think is very important to point out with Condon. Is I think a lot of the sort of fluidity and flexibility that he displays, I think a lot of that can come from a multi-sport background of, you know, not just the same repetitive actions over and over again, but, you know, building muscles that maybe you're using in water polo to stay afloat that you aren't necessarily using in basketball, right? That's a particular line of conversation that's fascinating to me, so I'm going to get way off track from that. But going back to the question you actually asked, I think that it's something that it's not just the balance thing. For me, what is more of a concern is the hesitation, generally. I mean, that's something that, you know, has been talked to death of, like, as the NBA becomes more of a 0.5 league, the guys who hesitate with the ball in their hands tend to have a harder and harder time of figuring things out because, you know, the concept is, hey, the ball's going to move. The players are going to move. If you're stagnant, then you're, you know, slowing down the offense. You're cutting off lanes for other guys because you're not making the quick reads when you need to make them. And for me, it's a weird dichotomy because it never feels like that when he's playmaking, but when he's like, am I going to shoot? that's when that, you know, the hitch that you're mentioning, that's when I start to notice that. And that's what concerns me more is, look, he's got the playmaking, and that is a huge part of his profile, and I don't want to underrate that by any stretch of the imagination. But again, you know, a lot of his potential avenues to earn NBA playing time going forward will be dependent on what kind of a shooter is this guy. And if he's hesitant, if he's not sure, if he's like, oh, should I not take the shot? Should I keep the ball moving? Like, if he had, you know, less of a conscience with his shooting trigger, I think that would open up a lot of other things. Because again, I don't really notice that when he's moving the ball, when he's making plays for others. It's really just when he's going through the decision tree in his head of, should I shoot? Am I set enough? Is the defender close enough that he's going to be able to bother the shot? Do I have enough time? That's the kind of thing where that hesitation would scare me more than anything else. Of like, if the shot continues to be slow, but he's willing to take them. Again, a huge part of the shooting problem for me with him in particular is, how much of a shooter is he? And we won't know until we see the volume. And if he's hesitating from putting the shots up, that's a bad sign for him,
yeah,
kind of, you know, being willing to continue to put up the looks that he needs to put up going forward.
Yeah, I agree with your point. It's kind of like, you know, when you look at his overall game, you know, his playmaking, especially off cuts, I think he shot 61% off cuts, which is kind of the same instincts, you know, when you're, you know, debating if you're going to shoot or pull the trigger. It's kind of like, should I cut right now? Should I wait? Should I, is, you know, is my, am I in the right position to actually, you know, cut to the ball at this position, or should I relocate out and create space? You know, he has great instincts in those particular areas. It's kind of like, how can he translate that to shooting and just, you know, letting it fly? Because, you know, if he gets that settled out, you're kind of looking at, you know, as you mentioned, you know, lottery conversations are for Condon. And going back to his playmaking too, you know, he had a 12.6% turnover percentage. You know, that's amazing for a big man. You know, I'm not trying to critique that, because that's something you don't really see in big man prospects. But that just contributes to, you know, how he is, you know, as the bread and butter of, you know, Florida's team last year. And when you look at, you know, Walter Clayton left, and they brought in Boogie Flan, they brought in Xavier Lee. You know, he's going to have a lot of these table setters too, that will open up the floor for him to, you know, possibly have more confidence, you know, getting a year under this belt with being such a strong part for Florida that he didn't have his freshman season, that I think it's going to make him more confident as a shooter of just letting it fly, that he already has with his playmaking and his off the ball movement.
Bringing up the guard room is a very important point. I don't think it's particularly often as a college big man when three of the guards on your team go get drafted in the NBA, and they're just replaced by three guards who are likely to get drafted this coming season, right? It's like, you don't...
He couldn't be in a better position.
Yeah, and you know, that's another thing too, is I think that's a blessing and a curse, honestly.
Yeah.
Because given where his offensive game is at, I would love to see him get more touches, just because then we have a better idea, right? A lot of my, you know, and I have a first round grade on him, right? He's a prospect that I brought up in our second episode. I very much wanted to talk about him, but you know, part of the struggle that I have with evaluating him is he does almost everything that you would want from a big man of, you know, his size and archetype and all of that, except there's just a few little tweaks that need to be made on the offensive end. And most of that is just, you know, again, even far more so than Gwath, I don't know what kind of a shooter he is. He shot 29% last year. It was on a tiny sample size. He was like in the high 30s for most of last season. Then he went ice cold down the stretch and, you know, ended up at 33%. But even still, tiny volume of attempts. Like, the fact that Florida is going to have so many great players once again this year after winning the national championship last year, he's going to get the ball in great spots. I'm just worried about, will he have the confidence he needs to pull the trigger? Because, again, he's surrounded by a bunch of great guards, and it would be entirely reasonable to go through the thought process of, hey, Boogie Flan is wide open in the corner. Should I really take the shot? Hey, Xavier Lee's got a great open cut to the basket. Do I feed him? I'm really good at those passes. I am open, but should I make that, you know, it's like, if there was more of a sort of requirement for him to be more involved in the offense, that might actually bode better for him than what the situation is going to be, which is Thomas Howe is going to take up a lot more of the offense than he did last year. And he's someone who certainly a lot of Nosings people are higher on than Condon at this point, right? You combine that with, you know, Boogie Flan coming along, Xavien Lee coming along. It's going to be crowded offensively. And I'm not sure if that's better or worse from him. I think if it changes, you know, the usage of like, okay, look, you're just going to get transition looks and spot up threes. That's it. If he can do that and do that at a high level, again, I don't think, you know, somewhere in the 15 to 20 range is out of the question or even unreasonable. But part of the problem is that the defense is easy to see, and that's going to be the calling card for him. But it's not a question, you know, like for Cone Carr, right? It's like, can he shoot is a much more open-ended question. Whereas for Condon, it's like, can he get to the point where he does enough of the offensive stuff? Because he's not someone who takes much off the table unless he doesn't shoot. And if he doesn't shoot, does he take too much off the table? I don't think so. I think he's good enough defensively that he should get run anyway, but his trajectory looks a lot different. If he shoots 4 threes a game this year and hits 31% of them, I'd be happier with that than if he hits, you know, 38% of a very similar 1.5 attempts per game.
Yeah, and I think another layer to his game too is that I love him in DHO situations, but another layer is, you know, can he pick and pop as well? Because you don't really want him dribbling the ball because his handle is very stiff and he just, that's not, you know, what you really want him to do, you know, on the perimeters, you know, taking a lot of dribbles. Yes, he obviously has that ability to in a dunker spot, but I think picking, you know, adding that layer to his game, he's more than capable of doing. It's just a matter of like, is he going to have the reps to do that? Is he going to have the confidence to do that? But I definitely want him to add that layer in, you know, addition to the catch and shoot opportunities. But I think a lot of his opportunities could be involved more in the pick and pop situation, especially with Flan, Lee. I love his, you know, big to big connection with Howe as well. And just going off the DHOs too, you know, he's great at cutting, but, you know, let's just back it up a little bit and, you know, just pop up to the perimeter and, you know, at least shoot, you know, as you mentioned, like at least 4 attempts per game, I think is kind of like the sweet spot for him this year.
Yeah, no, I'm completely with you. And I think the pick and pop thing is huge to point out because, again, if you have a big man like that, part of the appeal is the versatility of the screens, right? Of, okay, if he's setting a screen, it's not just he's going to rumble down the lane or he's going to slip the pick and try and cut in, right? It's like, okay, if you're running a pick and roll with him as the roll man, you have options, but he needs to come through on those options. He took 21 pick and pops all of last year. Yeah. That's just not enough for the kind of big man that you hope that he can be, right? And it's astonishing to me looking at the synergy numbers. His most frequent play type last year was post-ups, which is very, very strange. I mean, he was okay at them, but I don't get the logic behind that being what he's doing a lot of the time. But the fact that he was spotting up almost 3 times as often as he was being a pick and pop big, that to me just doesn't feel either that's not the best utilization of him or he's not as good as I think he is. I think it's the best way to put that, right? Of like, you want him doing that more, or you think that his shooting numbers from last year were kind of a mirage. And I'm hoping it's not the mirage option because the non-mirage option is a lot more fun.
Yeah, I think we have kind of a sweet spot too for, you know, modern, versatile, fluid big man that, you know, have the passing ability and kind of, you know, the shot shooting ability as well that we kind of want a little bit more out of, and those are prospects we kind of lean towards with. But I think definitely, you know, getting those attempts up will definitely open a lot of doors with him with such a crowded, you know, offensive, you know, teammates that he has with Flan and Lee and obviously Howe as his buddy down low.
All right. Shall we get to our final section and wrap things up here?
Yeah, let's do it.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing.
And Bubba Wallace.
You know what's the worst part of a race? A rain delay.
Sitting around, waiting for the track to dry, is dull.
But instead of waiting, we hang out with Chumba Casino.
Social casino slots, bingo, solitaire, plenty of fun to keep us entertained.
So why let a rain delay slow you down? Play now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Okay, so quick hits, puddle jumps, whatever, to wrap this up. Just, you wanted to talk about some of this stuff from NBA opening week, and there's really only one topic that interests me because the team that I cheer for personally is both bad and not fun, which is really a great combination, but it's getting to the point where I don't know what to even say about Victor Wembanyama anymore.
Yeah.
It's funny because, you know, that's one of the frequent topics of conversation in the No Ceilings group chat is, you know, oh, how, you know, how long could he keep this going? I'm worried. Is he going to get hurt? Like, is that?
Yeah.
And to me, that's like, you know, it's funny because a lot of the discussion that we had centered around Yao, which is entirely fair. Maybe this is just me being an old head in a lot of ways. But the first person that I thought of was Ralph Sampson of, it's not just how big he is, it's how fluid he is, it's how fast he is, it's how coordinated he is, it's how he does everything. It's not just, you know, like, for as spectacular as Yao was when he was healthy, like, you know, clear first ballot Hall of Famer, you know, one of the best players we've ever seen, he wasn't running up and down the floor, he wasn't taking step back threes, right? Like, it's the reason that I think Ralph Sampson and Kristaps before I think of Yao or anyone like that with Wembanyama is, to me, the thing that is most absurd about Victor Wembanyama is he might be the one person in the history of the NBA about whom you could say the following. If he was a foot shorter, he would still be an NBA player. I genuinely think that 6'6 Victor Wembanyama is, you know, not MVP defensive player of the year candidate player, but I think that guy makes his way onto a roster, right? And
yeah,
that's, you know, it's like, other than Muggsy Bogues, because if he made it at 5'3", he can make it at 4'3", right? Like, how many yeah, other people could you even say that about and not just get stared at like you're the most ridiculous person they've ever seen? Like, does 5'9 LeBron do the Isaiah Thomas thing? Like, maybe, but the only person I can say that about with confidence is Victor Wembanyama. And that is insane in so many different ways, but it's particularly ridiculous in the fact of, you know, his handle is as good as he is. His shot is as good as it is. And, you know, Nathan wrote about Victor in chat today for No Ceilings NBA. Go check that out, NoCeilingsNBA.com. But, you know, the part that I completely agreed with what Nathan was writing about is, the threat of the three is the real thing for Wemby. Of last year, him taking so many made defenses be like, oh, you know, we got to actually pay attention to this guy. And the thing is, if you get pump faked by Victor Wembanyama, he's at the rim before you turn around.
Yeah.
Like, that's,
yeah.
So, you know, again, there's not much that I want to or can say about the Kings, but really just the opening week of NBA basketball to me has just been, how do we find a way for Victor Wembanyama to stay healthy? Because the history of guys his size is not great. The history of human beings his size, you know, it tends to come with health problems, as one might expect if you think about it for more than 0.3 seconds. But
yeah,
I mean, last year was putting the league on notice. I don't even know what this year is. Just like,
it's the fear of Wemby, honestly. Yeah. I mean, defensive have no idea how to stop him. I mean, he's a 7'5" center that's averaging 31 points per game, and he's getting to the line more than ever. I think he's attempting like 10 free throws a game now. So just overall, and the Spurs are 4-0, which, you know, in, you know, a few years back, you'd be like, or is that like a typo just to start this season? I think it's just, you know, they're getting started, right? And I think from what I've seen and just, you know, watching this past week too, I definitely think, you know, not, you know, down our parade, Nick, as, you know, Suns and Kings fans, but Spurs are, you know, real threats in the West. I mean, you know, I think in the season, I usually do like, you know, preseason rankings or whatever fun stuff, but I have them as like, you know, a 4 or 5 seed, which I think is very easily doable with the pace they're going on. And obviously, if you look at, you know, Dylan Harper as well, he's had really exciting flashes. But it just comes to, like, how can you stop this guy that, you know, is just getting started too? And then if you look at the likes of Vijay Edgecombe, he kind of, you know, set the NBA on fire this past week too. And I think I read he has the most points in NBA history in his first three games, which is absolutely insane. And he's averaging, I think, like 31 points per game. And he just has been super fun to watch too for the 76ers.
Yeah, I'm glad you shouted out Vijay. It's really funny because a whole lot of the conversation last year was, you know, oh, there are questions about his shot, but this guy's going to be just all-world defender. Like, you can't drop this guy too low because he's going to get to the NBA and he's going to be like an all-defensive team guy in year two. And it's like, he comes out and he breaks the rookie record for like points in a debut. It's like, oh, yeah. Okay, so this is what we're doing. All right, that's fine. And yeah, no, he's been spectacular. Dylan Harper, I think, falls very much into the category of something that, you know, going back to the Suns and Kings fans thing, it's great that this is the time where both of our teams are so god awful because nobody other than the Thunder or the Spurs is winning the West for like 5 years. Like, I know that's way too strong at that point, and I don't entirely believe it, but like OKC is shooting 28% from three, and they're also 4-0. And, you know, as long as Victor Wembanyama is healthy, there's absolutely nothing that you can do about the Spurs. And, like, it's getting to the point where people are talking about, oh, I don't know, do they trade De'Aaron Fox? Dylan Harper is so good. It's like, well, you know, it's kind of an awkward time to be talking about trading De'Aaron Fox. But, like, you know, if he's playing, one of Stephon Castle or Dylan Harper is sitting. I'm not sure that's the best avenue for the Spurs, but the thing with the Spurs is like basically every problem that they have at this point is a good problem of like, oh, you know, what's the best way we can do this? But also it doesn't really matter because we're going to be up by 25 in the third quarter and Wemby's going to have 40, 15 and three with like seven blocks. He's averaging six blocks a game.
Like all you can do is laugh.
Yeah.
No, that's, when you that's look at his number. Like 13.8 rebounds this season, 12 of those on the defensive end of the ball. Like, he is just such an anomaly. And, like, he's just unbelievable.
It's just so many things are unfair about Victor Wembanyama. Yeah. I think the post that I saw that summed it up for me perfectly, I don't remember where I saw this, but just summed it up for me perfectly, is like, of course he has to be a mentality monster, too. It's like, of course he has to be the guy who's like training in Shaolin temples and like working out with Hakeem. It's like, couldn't this guy just like be a loser at something?
Yeah.
Like anything?
No, like you're trying to find something to like just not make him, you know, who he is. It's like, yeah. You can't find anything. Like the guy's a dog and like he's, you know, he's going to be the face of the league, if not arguably already, obviously. But yeah, it's been super fun to watch him.
Yeah, no, it's... Again, you said it. At a certain point, it's just like all you can do is look at it and laugh. It's like,
yeah.
God, I'm trying to remember. There was the one play where he blocked two shots in a row, kept both of them inbounds, and the Spurs recovered on the second one. He takes the ball up the court himself, pulls up from 35 and hits it. It's just like, what do you do?
Like, what are we doing here?
Yeah, exactly. Like what is the point of any of this other than like just watch him and enjoy and just hope he doesn't get hurt. That's all you can do. Just watch him be amazed.
Yeah. Like it's the Victor Wembanyama show. And you just gotta watch.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think that's going to do it for us this week. Anything you want to cover before you wrap this up?
No, I'm all good.
Well, be sure to check out all of our work over at NoCeilingsNBA.com. We, in addition to Nathan's article that I shouted out already that came out yesterday, as you're listening to this, today as we're recording it, we also had our preseason draft guide dropping on Monday. So great time to become a No Ceilings Plus subscriber. If you aren't already, you can get our very, very, very many words on our top 60 prospects heading into the season. Trust me, there's a lot of words. I edited almost all of them. If you've been enjoying the show, please take the time to subscribe, leave your rating and or a review in whatever podcast player you might be using. That's always much appreciated on our end. You can find Paige on social media at PaigeAutto_. You can find me on Blue Sky at NBA Johnson. And If you have any feedback regarding the deep dive specific portion of the podcast, feel free to reach out to either of us, to me, either on Blue Sky as mentioned, or email nickaj.nba@gmail.com. And as always, thanks so much for listening.